This talk was given by Prabhu Gikan Vasan at Zen Mountain Monastery. Gikan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Gikan. This passage is from The Way of the Bodhisattva. To the Buddhas, those thus gone, to the sacred Dharma, spotless and rare, and to the Buddha's offspring, oceans of perfect qualities, I make a perfect offering. I offer every fruit and flower, every kind of healing breeze, precious gems, and pure refreshing waters. Every mountain full of precious jewels, all sweet and lonely forest groves, trees with blossom, trees heavy with fruit, the perfumed fragrance of divine realms, all crops that grow without the farmer's labor, and every sumptuous object worthy to be offered. Lakes and marshes adorned with lotuses, delightful with the sweet cries of water birds, and everything unclaimed and free, extending to the margins of the boundless sky. So by nice coincidence, Shugen Roshi's opening remarks and some of the remarks that we've heard have actually drawn from the Way of the Bodhisattva. So it kind of works out nicely. I'm really happy to be talking about this. The Way of the Bodhisattva is a long poem composed by the 8th century monk Shantideva. And it begins with what's called the Seven Branch Prayer. And as I understand it, it's a series of practices to purify the mind and to make the mind, our minds, receptive to a teaching. In some ways, I think it's kind of similar to our Fusatsu, our renewal of vows ceremony, in that, you know, it's a way, and in Shantideva, he does acknowledge his karma, to acknowledge karma, to take refuge, and to re-express and renew our commitment to the Bodhisattva path. And the first part of that is what I just read. It's invoking the three treasures and making an offering, what Shantideva calls a perfect offering. You know, it's kind of funny. I'd been actively working with Shantideva's texts for a number of months right now. So it's interesting that when I was looking at it for this talk, I actually skipped right over the offering part. You know, I mean, Shugen said that I should address, because it's a Sesshin talk, he said I should address things that we might encounter in Sesshin, and I just went right to the chapter on like vigilant introspection, you know, where he says the mind is like an elephant, you have to tether the elephant. I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, that's what Sesshin is about. And I think that's just, thinking about it, I tend to do that when I'm reading some of these sutras. I tend to sort of skip over like the initial sort of introduction. So I want to slow down and to look at this part, look at the offering and see what it might have to teach us, and especially about Sesshin. So for me, I think the most significant thing about this offering is that there's no humans in it. Right? There's flowers, there's trees, there's lakes, there's birds, there's flowering trees and fruit-bearing trees. You know, there's mountains, but there's no people. In fact, the one place where he actually mentions people, he does so actively to exclude them. He said, "Crops that grow without the farmer's labor." You know, so it's like wild crops, right? So he really is starting off here by offering a world without us, a world without human activity, human consciousness, human intentionality. And so what kind of world is this? Well, according to Shantideva, it's a world that's perfectly at peace. He says, everything unclaimed and free, extending to the margins of the boundless sky. If you think about it, it makes sense, right? everything would be unclaimed because we're not there to claim it. Everything would be free because there's no one there to, you know, to own anything, right? There's no one there to impose anything. And of course, it would be a world that's boundless because there's no one to bind anything, right? We're not there to create boundaries, to create binds. I think some of you know that my wife, Hosui, and I are really into birds. You know, we do a lot of birding, bird photography. And on some of those walks, you know, I get this. You know, like that line that he says here, lakes and marshes with the sweet cries of water birds. I mean, that just kills me every time I read it, right? And if you love birds, it will kill you too, because that's just beautiful, right? And, you know, sometimes, yeah, you know, when we're sort of entering like a marsh or a lake or any place where there's birds, and we're just kind of entering it, right? So they don't know we're there. This is what it's like. You know, the birds are doing their thing. You know, they're flying and flitting and chattering and quarreling and squabbling and shitting and mating and eating and hunting and being hunted. And they're just doing all of that. They were doing all that before we even got on the scene. And if we leave them alone, they'll continue doing that, right, with absolutely no need for us. So this is what he starts with. And, you know, in some ways it reminds me of our first offering that we do here every day in Sesshin, the verse of the Kesa, right? It's the first kind of offering of our voice every morning. And, you know, I've sort of thought about how it begins. You know, vast is the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction. You know, it starts without requiring anything of us, right? It starts with just a statement, right? It starts with a statement of vastness, of liberation, and of beneficence as given. Right before then, you know, we then say how we're going to enter it. So Shantideva begins his perfect offering by, I think in some ways, offering perfection itself. So the question I go to is, where does this leave us? Right? Where do we come into all this? With supple garments and beautiful adornments, I grace the bodhisattvas. I place before the sages glorious flowers like lotus and mandarava and fragrant blossoms twined into lovely gardens. I offer incense and various foods and drink, all delicacies. I offer precious lamps arranged in rows on lotuses of gold, a carpet of sweet flowers. I give vast palaces decked with precious pearls and pendant gems, gleaming jewels that deck the amplitude of space. Precious parasols adorned with golden shafts, bordered round with hems of precious jewels, pleasing to the eye, all this I give to the Buddhas. That's how he continues. You know, I've come to see that, for me anyway, maybe for us, there's sort of two central challenges as religious practitioners, as spiritual practitioners. The first is how to move through a world that's full of discord. And for me, I sort of got that early on. I entered Zen practice around the same time that I started my master's in social work. So the two sort of kind of went hand in hand for me. So I got that, right? I got it. You know, how do we move through a world that's just full of conflict and turmoil? But more recently, I'm sort of becoming aware of maybe even a more basic challenge, and that is, how to move through a world that's perfect and whose perfection doesn't depend on us. How to bring all of our needs and drives and activities and creations into something that's already content, already harmonious, and already at peace without us. It's that fine but really clear line in birding when you're noticed. You know, I remember a while back, I was watching these red-winged blackbirds feeding their young. you know. And I was at a distance. They didn't notice me, and I was just kind of watching it through my binos. And it was really amazing. You know, it was a blazing hot day. And so, you know, there's a pair, a male and female, and one, they would take turns. One would actually cover the hatchlings with their wings, or his wings, to protect him from the heat, while the other one kind of flitted around and got a worm or a bug or something, and then would come, it would feed, you know. There seemed to be a pecking order. There's like a couple that seemed to get like the best morsels, and a couple of others that seemed to be always like hungry ghosts, kind of like opening their mouths and didn't get quite as much. But anyway, they were doing that, and then they would switch. And it was great. And then I decided to get closer. Now, I wanted to get more detail. I wanted to take a couple of more detailed photographs. So I just began getting closer and closer and closer. And I crossed that line. I crossed that line to where they began to notice me. And I didn't know that they were doing this. I was just completely, I just wanted to see. You know, I was totally into this. And but I noticed that that the male bird was no longer looking for worms. You know, he was actually kind of coming closer and closer to me. And it sort of ended when I kind of looked up from my camera, and he was just coming right at me. Like, I don't know if any of you have actually had a bird, like, just come straight for your face. But it literally, it's like a missile with, like, a point. Just kind of like just coming right at you. I mean, that's how they fly. And I think it was just complete reflex. I kind of shifted a little bit this way. He decided to shift just a little bit that way. And he just went, thump. And I have no idea if his tail grazed me or if it was the wind that he generated grazed me. But I just kind of felt this little, right? He's like whizzed right by me. And basically what he's saying, what I think he was saying was if he could put that into words, you know, he would basically have been saying, what are you doing here? You know, this was all good until you decided to come this close. Right? And we had a good thing going, and, you know, until you showed up. Right? So in this passage that I just read, Shantideva takes that perfect world and now fills it with us. Right? There's, you know, he fills it with our stuff, our gear, you know, fine clothing, jewelry, high cuisine, luxury items, palaces, you know. Josue and I were actually in Manhattan, I think about a month ago, and we were taking a bus on Madison Avenue. And as I was kind of reading this, I was sort of like, yeah, you know, that's pretty much what we passed every stretch of the way. You know, like the high clothing, the jewelry stores, places where you can get an umbrella for like $600, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not sure what the palaces would be. I don't know, like Trump Towers or something. But we passed it. But he's also filling not just with stuff, but with our human valuations. Right? There are certain flowers that are better than other flowers to offer. Right, an umbrella made of gold and pearls is better than an umbrella, is a better offering than an umbrella made of, you know, plastic and polyester. There's a palace is better to offer than a shack. This is where I think he gives us a place to enter. Right? Because he's doing what we do. He's producing stuff, he's using stuff, he's assessing, he's discriminating, he's drawing things, he's drawing high and low, which is what we do all the time. But I think what's different is that he's offering it all up. I grace the bodhisattvas, I place, I offer, I give, I offer, I give. Right? He's taking every bit of this human world, and he's offering it. You know, it's sort of like in the work gatha that we do here, the Sutra of Great Compassion. You know, it's pretty wild that, you know, before entering the world of human labor, right, we really set a context that this is something that we're giving up. Right, we're doing it. You know, we're doing it out of compassion. Right, that is, we're not doing it for ourselves. Right, we're doing it, but we're doing it in order to offer it up. And we used to do some of you might remember that before doing the Sutra of Great Compassion, we used to do another work gatha, and I believe the dedication was, may this compassionate dana be extended to all sentient beings, right? So before starting work, you know, we emphasize this is compassion, and we're extending it to everything. You know, every time we do liturgy, you know, the dedication, you know, we offer these merits too. You know, it really strikes me that so much of what we do here is essentially entering the way he enters, taking what's essentially human, labor, language, voices, stuff that like nothing else in the world seems to need, and we're going to do it, but we're going to offer it, or we're doing it as an offering. So he's entering and entering fully and using fully that unclaimed world, and he's not claiming any of it for himself. And I think, for me anyway, that changes everything. You know, a couple of months ago, we have this nature preserve near where I live called the Five Rivers Environmental Center, and I did a day of volunteering there for their fall festival, and I was assigned to the reptile tent, and specifically to work with the snakes. And so I spent the entire day handling snakes, and it was pretty awesome. If you've never handled a snake, like handle a snake, it's amazing. We had this long, like 4-foot, dark black python called Axel, and we had this smaller, beautiful rose corn snake. I'm like a corn snake. It looks like corn because it's got like those little kind of like kernels, but this one was rosy. So it was pinks and reds, and it was just stunning. Her name was Amber. Really soft like silk. Like you wouldn't think a snake could be this soft. So the entire day, groups of kids were coming to the tent, and it was our job to help them handle snakes. You know, and we spent the entire day doing this, and it was like the best time I've had in like a long time. And you know, it was amazing to see what happened, because you know these kids, a lot of them anyway, they were young, young kids to like preteen kids, and of course, you know, when we first took the snake out and said, hey, you want to hold the snake, most of them were like whoa, I'm not gonna hold a snake. Some of them were like, ugh. You know, but then you know we encouraged them, and they eventually, you know, allowed us to drape a snake on them. And the naturalist who was running this actually pointed out something really interesting. She said, watch what the snake does when you first drape it. You know, when we first draped it, and not just for kids, also adults, they were like really nervous. You know, like some of these kids were like not even breathing. They were so nervous. And the snake was completely tense. Like it was like a rod. It was just like... And she said, you know, it's seeing that this thing, it's sensing attention, and so it's figuring that there's danger someplace. It didn't realize that they're tense because of the snake, so it's totally stiff. And as these kids began to relax, right, began to breathe, began to soften up, the snakes began to soften. They began to get supple, right? They began to sort of move, they began to sort of adjust themselves. You know, we just told the kids, you don't have to do very much. You know, just kind of hold your hands like this, like you're cradling something, and just let the snake do the rest. The snake will figure out how it needs to be, you know. And so we spent the whole day doing this, and it was great. And as I was sort of reflecting on it, I realized how different that was than it often is when I'm out birding. Right. When I'm out birding, I'm really like gunning for like a good bird shot, like a good bird photograph. It's a very different mindset, right, than I have. I want that bird, you know, especially, you know, if Josue and I travel someplace because, you know, there's like a migration happening. Like, you know, like I spent money, you know, I want that bird. Like, you know, I want it. And... you know, just the mental things that I do, you know, like when I'm like, I'm like trying to telepathically like tell a bird what to do. You know, I'll be like, just you're backlit, like move just a little bit, just do it, just move into shadow, just do it, turn, just turn, you know, and like you know, like it's gonna like do this, right? And I get really intense about it, you know, and if that beautiful, stunning, colorful little warbler happens to like just bolt and like go over the tree line and just like disappear forever, it's just like, oh, you little shit, I cannot believe you just did that to me. Like, I can't believe it. You know, like I've been stalking this bird for like a half hour and now it's just gone. You know, just like a blur. And like I'm holding my camera here, like what just happened, right? In fact, this one time, Josue and I were on a trail, and I didn't have my camera with me. And she said, like, you know, there's a good chance we'll see, like, whatever, like some rare, like some kind of warbler or something like that. And I told her, you know, I really hope we don't see it. And she goes, why? And I say, because I don't have my camera with me. And she goes, like, you know, so you'd rather, like not see the bird at all because you can't take a picture? I said, yes. Because if I see the bird and I don't take a picture of it, like just the resentment would just kill me outright, like right on the spot, right? So this is what I get into when I go birding. And it was so different than what was happening at this environmental center, right? There was no agenda, right? I wasn't out to get anything. I was just there to be present for these kids, you know. And in fact, there wasn't even an end result with the kids. You know, some kids really said, no, I don't want to handle a snake, and that was perfectly fine. You know, we were just totally respected the fact that they didn't, and they got the experience of having that respected. Other kids were completely into it. They got that experience. You know, we were watchful, we were engaged, we were responsive. But there was no end game. It could have ended any way with any one of those kids, with the snake or not with the snake, and it was perfectly, perfectly fine. And it just, you know, it was, I wasn't claiming anything for that day, right? And it just, you know, it, and that intention, you know, that intention of entering a space and really wanting something out of it versus entering it just to be in that space and to be responsive in that space, for me anyway, it changes just about everything about that space. You know, in his commentary on this, text, the Dalai Lama points out that Shantideva really doesn't own any of the stuff that he's giving. You know, to think about it. And, you know, so he sort of points this out. But then he goes on to say that, you know, that's why he can offer it up in the way that he does. You know, he's not offering it in the sense that I own this and you, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, can now have it, right? He can offer it up in that way that he does because he's not establishing himself as having any piece of this or as really wanting to hold on to any piece of this. In fact, in some ways, I think what he's really offering is an abundance and a generosity that's already there, and that was already there before he even stepped onto the scene. So Sesshin. What does all this have to do with Sesshin? What can we pull out of this? You know, I think we might be able to start where Shantideva starts with perfection. You know, I was noticing during the couple of days of Sesshin that we've had, how there's that precept, see the perfection, don't speak of others' errors and faults. I notice that how I tend to break this when, as Sesshin begins to wear me down, you know, I really begin to focus on the errors and faults of Sesshin. You know, the schedule, whatever I'm asked to do, you know, at some point, you know, Shoan came over and asked me if I could be a server, and I was like, God, you know, like I was, it was going so well. Like I was like so on, you know, and now it's going to suck like completely. Like it just is, because that's just the way it is. And, you know, so I either focus on the errors and faults of Sesshin or on my own errors and faults. And so maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe if some of us do that, maybe a place to start is to see the perfection, right? The perfection of what happens in Sesshin, when we simply allow our experience to just be one thing that's happening without being the dominant thing that's happening, without our wants and how we'd like it to be. You know, I mean, I think it's a perfection that doesn't depend on getting what we want, because a lot of Sesshin is we're not getting what we want. We're getting pain, especially as these periods begin to rack up in Rahatsu. We're going to get exhaustion. We're going to get fatigue. We're going to get irritability. So maybe some of us were looking forward to working with Shugen Roshi in Dokusan, right, for this Sesshin, and it didn't work out that way, right? So, you know, the perfection of Sesshin can't be based upon it giving us what we want, because it's not going to do that. You know, we can try to understand Shantideva's description of the world as free and unclaimed as also being a really precise description of this, of Sesshin. You know, each time we bow and enter the Zendo for a period of sitting, we really are entering an unclaimed space. unclaimed because, you know, it hasn't happened yet, right? It will not be the same period as the period before. It won't be the same period as the period after, and it won't be the period that we think it is, right? So we can enter it in the way that we're not trying to claim it. We're not trying to establish, walking in here, what kind of period this is going to be. Right? And in some ways, it doesn't matter how we're establishing it. If we've had great zazen up until now, if we've had terrible zazen up until now, right? We can walk in with that way. We can walk in and claim it for that. Or we can walk in as completely unclaimed and just completely step into our practice. And if, you know, that means, if you're working with the breath, if that means that you're just simply starting over again at one, period after period, because you can't get to 10, like I did for years, right, day after day in Sesshin, you can just do that too. You can enter that way and be perfectly fine with that without establishing that it has to be any different. We can work with our zazen, with our specific practice, like Shantideva works, with the things of the world, right, with no need to own the outcome. I think this is especially important when things get difficult, which they will in Rahatsu, when you're working with pain, when you're working with difficulties in practice. You know, I was thinking that practice for me has been sort of like those snakes. You know, it really does respond to what I'm bringing to it. You know, if I'm stiff, if I'm tense, I mean, my breath is going to be stiff and tense, right? The koan that I'm working with is going to be stiff and tense. Awareness itself is going to be stiff and tense. And if I can soften into it, you know, my breath can be soft. Right, and if I can speak of it this way, in some ways, you know, I've seen that the if I trust the koan in some weird way, the koan seems to trust me. Right, it becomes supple. Awareness itself begins to move freely because I'm not trying to control its movement. You know, the snake lady told us that, you know, one thing you never do is to grab a snake by the throat. Right? It will, like, you know, it's just a habit. You know, it's a snake. You know, you got to control the thing, so you just grab it by the throat. It says it will always sense that as a threat, right? So, you know, maybe if we're in pain, we can see, you know, are we trying to grab that pain by the throat? If we're really trying to work with a question, are we trying to grab that question by the throat? Are we trying to grab our breath by the throat? Are we trying to bring in this need to control? Whatever we're encountering, are we just, you know, are we working with it in that way? And if so, can we work with it in a different way? Can we just trust that if we just relax our hold, the practice will take the shape that it needs to take? Right? And that shape is the shape of the practice. Right? And anything else is just what we're trying to establish as what the practice should be, as opposed to what the practice actually is when it's a living, breathing practice. And finally, we can not do what I did in the outset and skip over the offerings. Right? Just, you know, I was sort of since I knew I was giving this talk on offering, I was just keeping track of all the kinds of offerings that we do here in Sesshin. And there's so many of them, you know, from like the morning gatha all the way to Oryoke. I mean, Oryoke is essentially like offering after offering, right? The food offering, you know, offering a little thing for the ghosts, offering the tea. And, you know, we can try not to miss every little period of offering that happens. And we can almost use that to stitch our sesshin. And if we're in a place where we can't offer, we can study that. We can study our minds as it's struggling to offer. Yesterday at lunch, you know, when we finished cleaning up the bowl, I drank the tea with all the food in it, and it was so good. You know, something about the turmeric in the main bowl, in the tofu mixing with like the tea, well, tasted so good to me. And when the servers came with the bowl, I didn't want to offer it. You know, I mean, it's like what do we say? We're offering it to all the various spirits to satisfy them. Well, I don't want to offer it to them. I want this. It's so damn good. And so, you know, I studied myself. You know, as the bowl was put down, I poured it, and I marked that spot where I felt, okay, like, you know, I want the rest. And I kept the rest, you know. But that was, okay, you know, in a way, you know, it was just a moment of study. But for me, anyway, it was a telling moment of study, right? It was a moment where I saw right there, that's my point at that moment. So we can use offering even when we can't offer. We can make offering a practice. So I just want to end by just touching on where Shantideva goes from this point. To the Buddha, to the Dharma, and the sublime assembly, I bow. To the shrines and supports of practice, I bow. To abbots and teachers, and to all who practice the Dharma. Until the essence of enlightenment is reached, I take refuge in the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the host of bodhisattvas. So after offering, he does prostrations, and then he takes refuge, and then for the next 150 pages, he turns directly to the matter at hand. His karma, his failings, his weaknesses, and the various turnings of his mind as he moves through the world he finds himself in. So in other words, having made a perfect offering, he then completely offers his imperfect self. And he moves through this imperfect world. But he does it to the hilt. So I'd like to suggest that we can have that. We can do that too. Right? No matter where we are in this session, no matter how tight we are, no matter how much we think we can and can't offer, right, no matter how imperfect we think we are, we can do this. Right? We can offer our imperfect self completely. Right? And if we can only offer this much, we can offer that much, but offer it completely. We can offer and practice and offer and practice. We can have that kind of session. Thank you for your attention, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.